is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
Rashid Khalidi is the Edward Said Professor of Arab Studies at Columbia University and the director of the Middle East Institute at Columbia's School of International and Public Affairs. And he was an advisor to the Palestinian delegation to the Madrid and Washington Arab-Israeli peace negotiations from October 1991 until June 93, I believe. And I have to say that Professor Khalidi is among the most prominent members of the Middle Eastern studies community in the United States. And his latest book is Sowing Crisis, the Cold War and American Dominance in the Middle East. Professor Khalidi, thank you very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
I wanted to begin by asking you why you chose, what set you on the pace of trying to understand better the flashpoint, the events in the Middle East through how the activity was shaped by the Cold War.
Well, I think it was the fact that looking at the American-Iranian standoff over the past 8 or 10 years, more than 8 or 10 years, really, I came to see that some of the patterns that I had always, noticed in studying the Cold War and studying Soviet and American policy during the Cold War were still there, or that those patterns had sort of frozen into attitudes that persisted well after the end of the Cold War. And I came to the conclusion that the United States and Iran are in a sort of mini Cold War, or have been in a sort of mini Cold War for quite a while. So I think that was one of the first things that drove me to go back and look at the Cold War itself. But it was a subject that I had worked on really since the late 1970s, when I began to look at Soviet Middle East policy and to teach both American and Soviet Middle East policy at the American University in Beirut, where, again, I was looking at things from a somewhat different perspective than most analysts take, writing from the perspective of either Washington or Moscow.
Well, Professor, let's then begin with some of the critical analysis of the legacy of the Cold War in the current political climate of the Middle East.
Well, one of the things that, I argue in this book, and this is not an entirely original insight, obviously, is that the Cold War, like any war, I suppose, involved a sort of simplification of things. It involved a reductionist approach to the other, to the opponent, both by the United States and the Soviet Union. And this is very much what we've had, especially during the 8 Bush years, the 8 dark years of George W. Bush, when we went from a country which was aligned against what Ronald Reagan called an evil empire to what George W. Bush called an axis of evil, when this obsessive and, some people would argue, exaggerated fear of communism sort of transmogrified into what some people would argue was an exaggerated fear of terrorism, or put it differently, where we were scared about communism back in the 50s and 60s, and we were scared by the government about terrorism, or terrorism was used to scare people. And so I found some uncanny similarities, really, in that. And I found further uncanny similarities in the way in which the United States moved almost seamlessly, it was a short interval, but almost seamlessly, from this posture of confrontation with the Soviet Union throughout the Middle East to a posture of confrontation with Iran and its allies and clients in the Middle East over the past, more than a past decade. This goes back to the Iranian Revolution of 1979, in fact.
Well, one of the things, which you had mentioned to me when we spoke in preparation, really, for this interview, is there's the issue of the U.S., which I definitely want to get back to and figure out how it kind of grounded and rooted itself geopolitically within the Middle East, to some extent within the context of the Cold War. But there were other areas that were brought into the process as well.
Well, one of the things that I wanted to really stress in this book was that most people who work on the Cold War talk about the Cold War in terms of which of the superpowers obtained an advantage, or which was at fault, or which was responsible, or essentially the focus is on the superpowers. One of the things I wanted to do in this book was not so much to keep score for the superpowers or hold them responsible, but to say, what impact did their rivalry have on this region? How did this region fare as a result of the superpower rivalry? And I came up with two major conclusions. The first was that the superpower rivalry made regional conflicts much, much worse It's not to say that the superpowers started the Arab-Israeli conflict or started the Iran-Iraq war or started the Lebanese civil war, but each of these conflicts that I examine was basically instrumentalized by the superpowers as an arena for their competition, and in that process where they turned these into areas where they sought to obtain advantage over one another, they made these conflicts much, much worse. I go in at great length through the Arab-Israeli conflict to show how, especially from the 60s onwards, it escalated and escalated, not just because of the occupation of Arab lands or whatever was going on between Arabs and Israelis, but also because this became seen as a proxy war by both the Soviets and the United States, who dramatically increased weapons shipments, dramatically increased their diplomatic support, and turned this into a much, much more deadly, lethal, virulent conflict than it had been before. So that's the first conclusion. The second is that this rivalry also had a very severe negative effect on the democratization process in the Middle East. And, you know, the Middle East was a region that had a feeble record with democracy before the Cold War hit it. But there was some serious efforts to build parliamentary democracies. And these faced internal problems, but they also faced the fact that both superpowers were, for almost everything else in the Middle East then, furthering democracy. And I in particular look at the Iran case, where the United States and Britain overthrew a parliamentary regime, and where before that Stalin did a number of things that undermined that parliamentary regime. And at Lebanon and at Jordan, weak countries with fragile democracies, which were quite harmed, I think, in the 1950s. By sort of the backwash of the Cold War.
I think most of our listeners certainly are familiar with and think about the Cold War as unfolding primarily really within Afghanistan.
Right.
And I don't think...
Or ending there, certainly.
Or ending there, in a manner of speaking. But again, part of what your book is actually, it doesn't really end, because the whole legacy and the pattern and practices continue. And it's certainly not just about the search for oil, nor is it just about the setting up of the kind of strategic military bases. Mm-hmm. So elaborate on that as well.
Well, one of the things I talk about, and I use Afghanistan as the sort of linchpin of this argument, is that we're still stuck with the toxic debris of the Cold War. The Cold War did not end in the sense that the instruments that both the United States and the Soviet Union employed during the Cold War continued to function thereafter. Taliban and Al-Qaeda, for example, were creations, or put it differently, grew out of things that were creations of the attempt to find weapons to strike at the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan during the 1980s. And long after the Soviet Union had withdrawn its troops from Afghanistan, long after the Soviet Union had crumbled and the Cold War was over, these instruments, as it were, of the Cold War continued to evolve and develop into what ultimately became Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Similarly, I argue, the methods of the Cold War, the covert operations, the ideological waging of ideological war and so forth, continued to feature in the arsenal not only of the United States, but also, I would argue, of Russia today, and to a certain extent, I would argue also of countries like Syria, local countries like Syria and Iran. So the legacy of the Cold War, in that sense, is still with us in a number of ways.
Well, let's go into some of those numbers of ways, which are fleshed out in the book. So the legacy of the Cold War, but we're talking about the immediate period, how it manifests itself, and how that superpower or that Cold War rivalry continues to play out and elevate and escalate, really, the conflict and tension within that region.
Well, I mean, one way I would argue is the very war metaphor. You know, the Cold War was obviously not a hot war, except in those places in East Asia where it did, and Southeast Asia where it did turn into a hot war, in Korea and Vietnam. It was war in all but name, in the sense that the United States and the Soviet Union mobilized against one another in multiple arenas without ever actually going to war, fortunately. But the war metaphor led to the kind of suspicion and fear inside the Soviet Union and in the United States, fear of spies, fear of subversion, fear of the other side eventually dominating, which mobilized society and strengthened the executive authority and ultimately, I would argue, weakened the republic in the United States. and its institutions. That metaphor has unfortunately endured during the Bush administration with the metaphor of the war on terror. And I argue in this book, which I finished before the 2008 election, that it remains to be seen whether the new administration is going to be able to completely turn the page on this rhetoric and the approach that comes with it. One of the things I argue in this book is that even though the United States was involved in this vast confrontation with the Soviet Union over several decades in the Middle East, it and the Soviet Union had a relatively limited military profile in this region. There were Soviet bases, there were American bases, but since the Cold War ended, this base structure and this American military presence has almost metastasized. And we now have the largest commitment of American forces outside of our territory since the Cold War in the broader Middle East region, running from Northern Africa through the Middle East and into Afghanistan and Central Asia, since World War II. It's really quite remarkable, and Americans don't seem to notice that this is an anomaly, that this is something strange and unusual, that even during the Cold War, against a formidable rival, the Soviet Union, which was another superpower, the United States did not have this many troops and was not this deeply engaged militarily in the region.
Well, one of the things that was troubling me as I was reading your book, which I still to conclude I'm about three-quarters of the way finished, was that what you set up for us is an institutional situation. It's certainly rooted in policy, but it's become so institutionalized and, as you said, metastasized, really, so that it seems that whether it's Obama or what have you, I don't see how one begins to extricate oneself. We have a military-based economy. We are now so rooted in the philosophic bent and the actuality that, as you point out, really was created and enhanced during the Cold War,
right,
that I don't know how you dismantle or move beyond that. And that's without looking at, obviously, the philosophic realities of the Israeli lobby and other things that make it virtually deadly for any politician to talk about representation, certainly, of the rights of Palestinians and so on. So I was a little demoralized in some ways.
Well, I mean, it is demoralizing when you think of, I talk in the book, this is long before the current controversy over the F-22, which mercifully is about to have the plug on it pulled by the Pentagon, only for us to hear that the F-35A is going to be put on steroids. Anyway, I talk in the book about the fact that the F-22, the Raptor, was an aircraft designed to achieve air superiority over the Soviet Air Force. And the thing is still being produced today in 2009, almost 20 years after the Soviet Air Force ceased to exist. So these things take on a life of their own as a function of what President Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex. And at the end of the book, you'll see when you get there, I quote not only that phrase of President Eisenhower, but a large chunk of his of the farewell address in which he used that phrase. And he makes a very sophisticated argument about the danger to the republic of this permanent establishment in time of peace. And you have here talking somebody who certainly knows what he's talking about when it comes to the military, and he's a former five-star general. I also quote a long passage in Washington's farewell address where he makes an analogous warning. And I don't think it's a coincidence that the two American presidents who had the most extensive experience of command of armed forces and of thinking about these kinds of strategic issues should have warned the most gravely against the United States falling into this kind of situation. They certainly were not pacifists, either of them. They were both generals. And yet they both warned that this is a danger to the fiber of the republic. So I do touch on this at length in the book, because to me it's the thing that worries me the most. Not just the damage that's being done to this region, and I would argue probably is done to most other regions of the world, or was done to most other regions of the world by the Cold War, but the damage that's done to this country. And the worst thing about it is that in time of war, it's not just the money. It's the concentration of authority in the executive at the expense of other branches of government, at the expense of the citizenry, and ultimately at the expense of democracy. In strong democracies in the United States, Britain, France, in World War I and World War II, that process was almost inexorable. You know, Clemenceau or Lloyd George or President Wilson or in World War II, Winston Churchill or Franklin Roosevelt wielded power that presidents before them had couldn't dream of. But wars end, and then that executive power, at least there's a chance of clawing it back to other branches of government or to the people. And the problem with the Cold War is that it was a permanent situation, or it was envisaged as almost a permanent situation. And so you had the development of a national security state and of a military-industrial complex that Eisenhower talks about, which is unprecedented in American history, and in fact, in some ways, unprecedented in the history of modern democratic governance. And we now face a continuation of that problem in that the war on terror was projected to be a war without end. Now, even if we dismantle that metaphor under the Obama administration, or the administration discards it, it doesn't use it anymore, I think that the reality may still be with us.
Professor, I just want to depart from the book for a moment, and I do have to tell people that Sowing Crisis, the Cold War, and American Dominance in the Middle East continue to root me in a much more profound understanding of the evolution of the conflict and the role, certainly, of this country within the context of the Middle East. And it's a very digestible, it's a very readable, it's a very engaging book, and for anybody, and frankly, everybody should. Since this is one of the critical flashpoints of the world, really read this book by Professor Khalidi. But my departure goes back to, I remember seeing a picture of yourself with Barack and Michelle Obama in the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself, and I'm going to really ask now, I had this momentary glimmer of hope that perhaps some member of the administration would be somebody with your kind of studied sensitivity and disposition towards Palestinian liberation, really, in the area. Well, that was not necessarily to be, but if you do still have the ear of Mr. Obama, or even without that, just through your scholarship, where do we go now in terms of, or where should we go in looking at the context of the Middle East and certainly a state for the Palestinians, which I can't help but say looks increasingly unviable given the nature of the Israeli settlements and indeed the geopolitical relationships that continue to unfold, particularly relevant to Israel and Palestine?
Well, I mean, I don't have anybody's ear in particular. That's why I write books, so that people can, you know, anybody who wants to can pick the book
up. I want you to know Mr. Obama is listening to this broadcast as we speak.
I'm sure that that's the first thing he does in the morning. I guess he has a couple things to do now, walk the dog. But I think that I'd make a couple of arguments. The first is the United States is gravely affected by whatever happens in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict because everybody sees the United States as responsible. Everybody in the world rightly sees the United States as in some measure responsible for what Israel does. Israel is the United States' closest ally. The United States gives Israel a great deal of money and the weaponry with which it does what it does. And the United States protects it, shields it from international opprobrium, which would be universal but for the American support in the Security Council. So that, the first thing is, whatever Israel does, good, bad, indifferent, and some of it in Gaza, for example, was quite awful, or in Lebanon 2 years ago, a little more than 2 years ago, in the summer of 2006, those things are seen as are identified with the United States. And so if the president or if any American leader has a wish to render the United States less disliked in the world, the first place to start, after, I would argue, Iraq and Afghanistan and detention issues, which, at least in terms of Iraq and detention issues, this administration has begun to address, maybe not entirely satisfactorily, the place to start would be the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, not just because the Arabs and the Israelis are important people and, you know, one wishes for their peace and security, but because it directly affects the United States, the world over. I think people are more baffled by this American foreign policy than almost anything else the United States does. They just don't understand why the United States has the position that it has vis-a-vis this conflict. So that's the first argument I'd make. The second argument I would make is there is not an awful lot of time. Processes have been in motion since 1967 to make sure that there can be no two-state solution of this conflict.
And you were listening to Rashid Khalidi, who is the Edward Said Professor of Arab Studies at Columbia University and Director of the Middle East Institute of Columbia's School of International and Public Affairs. Next up, selections from Rethinking Afghanistan by Robert Greenwald and Brave New Films.
Simply sending more U.S. troops to Afghanistan will not solve the problem.
People talk about troops. Well, we should really be talking about what's their strategy. How is this going to benefit local Afghans?
The possibility of casualties can make create more enemies or insurgents.
There's a saying right now in the U.S. military is that when you bomb a village and kill a civilian, you've lost that village forever.
There's only one way to win a counterinsurgency, and that is to bring the population over to your side.
Today we are losing the battle of the hearts and minds.
What we are witnessing is a regional and local nationalist opposition to American and Western military control.
Each warlord in each district, in each province, he has his own country.
We are sending hundreds of thousands of people into these countries who do not share the religion, who do not understand the culture.
The Afghans are probably the world champions in resisting foreign domination and infiltration into their country.
It's been known as a graveyard of many great armies.
There is a need for U.S. to think about another way to deal with this.
This is not a military problem, and it cannot be resolved by military means.
Afghanistan is unstable, then Pakistan is going to be unstable.
I think the real instability in Pakistan comes from within the Pakistani state.
Almost all the extremist leadership is actually based in Pakistan.
The religious fundamentalism today is a result of the war in Afghanistan, which is spilling over into Pakistan.
People are very suspicious of the United States and whether or not the United States has good intentions for Pakistan.
The United States has a very important interest in a stable Pakistan, a country that's endowed with several dozen nuclear weapons.
We could find nuclear weapons in the hands of Al-Qaeda.
Whatever happens in Afghanistan has a direct impact on Pakistan.
The United States has given this country billions of dollars. Where is the money gone?
History makes clear that you cannot have peace in Afghanistan without cooperation from Pakistan.
The sooner the U.S. gets out of Afghanistan, the better the chances of Pakistan being stabilized.
It should be engraved on the minds of every American diplomat. Do nothing that will further destabilize Pakistan.
Wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are the first wars we've ever fought, significant wars, where we haven't raised taxes.
You can't fight a war and finance it the way we have without it having an impact on the economy.
So for every soldier in Afghanistan, there are two contractors. There are 30,000 soldiers and there are 71,000 contractors.
In California, this state will pay more than $24 billion to fight the U.S. war in Afghanistan.
Congress is a part of the problem on getting control of our defense budget.
It's costing us about $2 billion a month for the 30,000 troops that we have right now.
Sending the additional 30 looks very much like it's going to more than double those costs.
We have paid for the entire war to date through borrowing, and we have to repay that money with interest.
Companies like Lewis Berger will often charge 10 times more than a local contractor will.
A lot of people also ask, why is the United States coming here and spending all of this money and we're not seeing this money? And there's been very little improvement in these areas over the last 6 or 7 years.
There is so much waste, so much inefficiency, so much absurdity in what we're doing at the moment.
We also have to think about all of the long-term care for veterans. These things are very significant long-term costs.
These two wars qualify at least as a contributing cause of the economic calamity that we are trying to deal with at present.
If you continue on this current pace, what you're talking about is a war that will cost, by the end of this decade, close to $1 trillion.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our new website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.